Top stories. Iraqi media say a major U.S. military base near the capital, Baghdad, has come under a rocket attack. A new report hits out at the U.S. military for its failure to properly address civilian casualties during its operations. And Iran calls on the United Nations to take immediate action to halt the massacre of defenseless Yemeni people by the Saudi-led coalition. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Iraqi media say a military base housing American forces near Baghdad's international airport has come under attack. According to the media reports, the base known as Camp Victory was attacked by six rockets. Still no word on possible casualties or material damage. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility either. Camp Victory and other U.S. military bases in Iraq have frequently been attacked. In the past months, the incidents have grown since the U.S. assassinated top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and a senior Iraqi commander in January 2020. Both were key anti-terror icons. Their assassination gave a rise to calls for the withdrawal of American forces from Iraq. The U.S. military has been under intense pressure over a drone strike in the Afghan capital last year. Now, a new study says the Pentagon is to blame for, quote, considerable weaknesses and inconsistencies in assessing civilian casualties. The study is conducted by a global policy think tank, the RAND Corporation. It concludes that systematic weaknesses of the Department of Defense were causing it to fall short of its duties in addressing civilian harm. The study also finds that the U.S. military complicates the problem by failing to get adequate information from sources outside the government or armed forces. The August 29th drone attack killed at least 10 civilians, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially blamed or claimed that the target was Daesh terrorists, but the Pentagon ultimately called it a tragic mistake following the release of the airstrikes video by the Central Command. We've spoken to Mike Harris, an editor with Veterans Today. He explains why the U.S. military is repeatedly causing civilian casualties in its operations overseas, despite an existing outcry.
Well, the U.S. Military, the Department of Defense, has fallen to a level of incompetency which is beyond imagination. This is due to a multitude of factors, among them the fact that the U.S. military is not doing its constitutionally mandated job of defending the borders. We have open borders in the U.S. that are bringing drugs and illegal aliens into the country, and our military is malapplied overseas fighting wars that have nothing to do with U.S. security. We all know that Afghanistan had nothing to do with 9/11, but yet that was the stated mission, when the real mission in Afghanistan was to secure the opium production and the poppy production, which if you look at how that's impacted the U.S., in the year 2000, there were 5,000 deaths a year due to opium-related deaths, and in the year 2020, that had escalated to over 93,000 deaths per year from opium. So the U.S. has lost its mission. The military has lost its mission. It's being corrupted from the inside out.
The Syrian military prosecution says it has obtained and documented evidence on numerous U.S. violations in Syria. During the years-long war, it also vowed to judicially pursue all Americans who committed crimes or undermined the state's sovereignty. Mohammed Ali reports from Damascus.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or U.N. mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S. Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions, and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Iran calls on the UN to take immediate measures to halt the massacre of defenseless Yemenis by the Saudi-led coalition. In a letter to the UN representative for Yemen, a senior advisor to Iran's foreign minister says, Tehran condemns bombings of cities, civilian buildings, and infrastructure of Yemen. Ali Asghar Khaji says the Saudi-led coalition's atrocities run counter to international laws. He says the Yemen's crisis has no military solution. The Iranian diplomat also calls for the lifting of a Saudi-imposed blockade on Yemen that has exacerbated the country's humanitarian crisis. The Saudi-led coalition has carried out dozens of deadly airstrikes on Yemen this week. In one such attack, more than 90 people were killed when the coalition's warplanes bombed a prison in Yemen.
Yemen continues to reel from a Saudi attack on a prison facility in Sa'dah province, with the number of fatalities continuing to rise. The airstrike that took place early on Friday left hundreds of people dead and wounded. Mohammed Al-Khulaidi was one of the victims. He describes how he was injured.
The missile hit ward number 3, and I was in ward number 2. My mates and I were sitting and chatting about our release from prison and how our cases will stand with a judge, and what would happen after we are released. Then the plane struck at around 1:30 or 2 a.m. Suddenly, piles of debris were on top of me.
Yemenis say there was no military target nearby the prison, and the attack was unjustified.
There were only inmates in the facility. There were no forces to be targeted. Even there weren't pickup trucks. Why did they strike? I don't know why they hit us.
Yemeni officials are calling for an international investigation into the latest Saudi bloodshed.
We denounce this act against those prisoners who were killed unjustly by aggressors. Some of the victims are children. The Saudi-led coalition has crossed all red lines. We call on the international community and human rights organizations to stop the Saudi aggression, condemn this attack, and bring its perpetrators to justice.
The air raid drew widespread condemnation, including from the UN, which also called for a transparent probe.
The Secretary General condemns the airstrikes launched by the Saudi-led coalition against a detention center in Sa'dah. Attacks directed against civilians and civilian infrastructures are prohibited by international humanitarian law. The UN calls for prompt, effective, and transparent investigations into the attack.
Iran has also condemned the attack, calling on the UN to hold the perpetrators of the crime to account. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Since then, hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives. Despite relentless Saudi bombardments of the impoverished country, the Yemeni armed forces and allied Ansarullah fighters have gradually grown stronger, leaving Riyadh and its allies, most notably the UAE, bogged down in the country. They have repeatedly conducted retaliatory attacks deep inside Saudi Arabia. A turning point in the conflict came last week when the Yemeni army opened a new retaliatory front targeting the UAE capital Abu Dhabi and its commercial hub Dubai, with drones and ballistic missiles. The army called the attacks a warning to Emiratis to change their stance and keep away from Saudis. Despite the enormous loss of lives and destruction of vital infrastructure in Yemen, the UN has done nothing to stop the mayhem and has only released a few statements once in a while. This as Riyadh continues to receive arms from its Western backers, most notably the United States and Britain. With no end in sight, the situation seems to be bleak for the Yemeni people unless a collective international effort is made to stop the aggression.
The U.S.-led Saudi Emirati coalition of aggression continues its massacres against the Yemeni people. From infrastructure to residential compounds, the Saudi Emirati war machine did not stop carrying out its holocaust in various governorates. This escalation coincides with the coalition launching a few days ago a military air operation on Hudaydah. Results of the massacres is horrifying. More than 100 martyrs and more than 120 wounded as a result of raids launched on a central prison in Saba. Yemen's Ministry of Health confirmed that more than 50 people are still under the rubble of the prison that was bombed by the coalition, while scores of children lost their lives in Hudaydah as a result of targeting a football field. Death, blood, and destruction is the result of rogue families ruling over the Arabian Peninsula. Saudi Emirati war crimes in Yemen this week on the Mideast Stream.
South Korea's COVID cases keep surging, with the country logging yet another record in its daily infections. South Korea posted more than 16,000 new infections for Thursday. That's the highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. Daily COVID infections hit record highs on Wednesday and Tuesday as well. They have been rising steadily in the past 2 weeks because of the Omicron variant that is highly contagious. Health authorities in South Korea are now warning that daily caseloads could surge to five-digit figures in the coming weeks if the current pace of the Omicron spread continues. The government has extended restrictions on businesses to contain the virus. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro denounces the opposition for its attempt to recall a referendum against him.
The attempt to reactivate the revocation referendum by the opposition against the president was a major fail. It's stupid, it's childish, and it's part of the attacks the opposition has carried out in Venezuela over the last few years.
Venezuela's National Electoral Council has declared the president's opponents did not collect enough signatures for the vote against him. The bid needed 4.2 million signatures, actually, of support to go ahead. But according to the Electoral Council, roughly 42,500 were received. Under Venezuela's constitution, officials who have completed at least half of their term can be removed from office by a vote. President Maduro completed the first 3 years of his second term just earlier this month. The opposition blames him for the existing economic hardships. Maduro says U.S. sanctions, including those on oil, are to blame. Political commentator Gloria Larriva says the latest setback for the Venezuelan opposition reveals that it does not have any mobilizing ability.
President Maduro has been president for the second term since January 10, 2019, and there have been multiple attempts, coup plots, and this self-naming by Juan Guaido in late January of that year, 2019, and they have failed every time. And in these 3 years before the pandemic, the forces that support the government, that support President Maduro, the left, the people have mobilized weekend after weekend before the pandemic hit to show their support for the government, while the right-wing opposition had no mobilizing ability. And that was shown in this failure to collect the 4.2 million signatures necessary for a recall.
Iran has won the ticket for the 2022 Qatar World Cup after winning over Iraq at Tehran's iconic Azadi Stadium. On that, we have our correspondent Saman Kojuri reporting.
Iran has become the first Asian team to qualify for this year's World Cup in Qatar with a 1-0 win over Iraq in Tehran. Mehdi Taremi scored the only goal of the match to send Iran through to the World Cup finals for the sixth time. Team Melli consolidated their position on top of the Group A table with 19 points, 2 points ahead of South Korea. They extended their impressive unbeaten run since Croatian head coach Dragan Skocic took over in February 2020 with 11 wins and 1 draw.
We have an astonishing team. All of them played pretty well. We thank them. We're now the first Asian team at the World Cup.
I am so grateful to all the players. We are proud of them. I am so happy that we have qualified for the World Cup. I thank Mehdi Taremi for his goal.
Iwan has played in the World Cup 5 times in the past, in 1978, 1999, 2006, 2014 and 2018, while Iwak's last and only participation was in Mexico, back in 1986. Iranian women were allowed Thursday to watch the match at Azadi Stadium in Tehran. 2,000 of the 10,000 tickets were exclusive to women for the 2022 World Cup qualifier between Iran and Iraq. Meanwhile, Iran's win poured many people out to the streets across the country to celebrate the fastest qualification for the World Cup.
With its win over the Iraqi team, Iran has won the ticket for the third time in a row to attend the World Cup, this time due in 2022 in Qatar. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Lebanese resistance fighter and Europe's oldest political prisoner, George Ibrahim Abdallah, is back in French courts trying to finally win his freedom. The anti-imperialist hero has been subjected to nearly 4 decades in prison due to pressure from Israel and the United States. And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last Friday. And here are ayahs 37, 38, and 39 of Surah Tur.
أم عندهم خزائن ربك أم هم المسيطرون أم لهم سلم يستمعون فيه فليأت مستمعهم بسلطان مبين أم له البنات ولكم البنون.
Do they possess the treasuries of your Lord? Or are they the controllers of their dispensation? Do they have a ladder leading up to heaven whereby their eavesdrop? If so, let their eavesdropper produce a manifest authority on the conversation of the angels. Does the Lord Most High have daughters while you have sons? If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last Friday, we said the Noble Quran, as the revealed word of the one and only creator of the universe, raises certain questions to open the dormant minds of human beings, especially of the disbelievers, by presenting the most significant philosophical discussions in the simplest form of expression, so that they ponder upon facts and realities in a rational manner, in order to refrain from obstinacy against the manifest truth. Since mankind has been created for a purpose, and is neither the creator of itself nor the creator of the world of existence, the heavenly scriptures revealed to the prophets for guidance of the human race point out that those who do not believe in their message are actually not responding to the bidding of their own reason out of their vile disposition of mind and pursuit of vain desires. It is the proper use of God-given intellect that helps us when we are in the pursuit of truth. It is pondering on one's own self and the world around leads to God and certainty. The ayahs that we recited to you now pose the question to the disbelievers if they are in possession of the treasures of the world that have made them needless and granted them sway over everything, or do they have access to the heavens where they could eavesdrop on the knowledge of the higher world? And if this is true, then it is incumbent upon them to produce evidence arguments as to what they have heard and learned from the conversation of the angels. In other words, people who have no access beyond the world of nature and are unaware of the metaphysical world may not claim to have availed themselves of intellectual perfection, when the fact of the matter is that the spirit of the Prophet of Islam is conjoined with the metaphysical world, since he possesses the supreme intellect and is the first being to be created by God Almighty. The next question to the disbelievers, who, out of ignorance, claim that the angels are daughters of God, while they have been granted sons, is that the Almighty Creator is needless of human characteristics to beget daughters or sons, when, in terms of human values, there is no difference between the male and female offspring, and thus such claims expose the falsity of their beliefs. From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one, it is logic and sound reasoning that testify the correctness of belief and should be accepted without prejudice, not illogical claims. And number two, those who attribute improper things to God have no inhibitions in accusing prophets of sorcery. Here, we present you Ayah 40 of the same surah, which, in order to refute the claims of the disbelievers and to show that divine guidance does not require any remuneration from the people, poses a rhetorical question to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
أَمْ تَسْأَلُهُمْ أَجْرًا فَهُمْ مِنْ مَغْرَمٍ مُثْقَلُونَ
Do you ask them for a reward so that they are weighed down with debt? This ayah means to tell the disbelievers, has the Prophet asked you of any reward for his preaching of Islam? And you are unable to pay it and thus deny his mission? The same question is recurrently mentioned in the Noble Quran regarding the missions of the prophets of the past who used to tell their nations that there is no remuneration required from them in accepting the divine call. If you remember, Ayah 23 of Surah Shura explicitly provides the answer of the Prophet of Islam to the Arabs when they thought of compensating him for the trouble taken to guide them towards light from darkness of disbelief and polytheism. He was commanded by God Almighty to tell them and to all Muslims of the coming generations that as a token of their gratitude for his selfless efforts, he does not ask for any reward, except the affection and reverence for his divinely designated successors, that is, members of his blessed progeny, the Ahlul Bayt, to whom obedience is required for adherence to the straight and unwavering path. From this ayah, we learn that, number one, no remuneration is required from the people for guiding them to the path of God Almighty. Number two, for proper propagation of religion and spiritual moral values, preachers should refrain from raising material and financial demands or imposing burdens upon the people. And number three, for every true believer, it is obedience after the Prophet to the path of the divinely designated Imams of the Ahlul Bayt that ensures salvation in life and the hereafter. invite you to listen to ayahs 41, 42, and 43 of Surah Tur in conclusion of this week's episode.
أَمْ عِنْدَهُمُ الْغَيْبُ فَهُمْ يَكْتُبُونَ أَمْ يُرِيدُونَ كَيْدًا فَالَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا هُمُ الْمَكِيدُونَ أَمْ لَهُمْ إِلَهٌ غَيْرُ اللَّهِ سُبْحَانَ اللَّهِ عَمَّا يُشْرِكُونَ
Do the disbelievers have access to the unseen, which they write down? Or do they seek to outmaneuver Allah? But it is the faithless who are the outmaneuvered ones. Or do they have any God other than Allah? Clear is Allah of any partners that they may ascribe to him. These ayahs once more address the disbelievers by asking whether they are aware of the secrets of the unseen, which they are to write down. Do they claim to have direct knowledge of divine injunctions and are thus needless of the noble Quran and the Islamic faith? If the disbelievers imagine that they may be triumphant over the Prophet of Islam by getting together to plot against him and thus defy God's commandments, they are totally wrong, since the Almighty's Creator's omnipotence is superior to all powers, and it is them who will be the losers. If the disbelievers imagine they have a patron, deity, or object of worship besides Allah, they are grossly mistaken, since the Almighty Creator is far too glorious to have any partners or associates. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, one of the methods to invite the misguided persons is to raise logical questions to awaken their dormant conscience and make them contemplate upon the manifest truth. Number two, anyone except prophets and their divinely designated vicegerent who claim to have connection with the unseen should be rejected. And number three, the Almighty Creator is superior to everything and is the real supporter of all those who seek truth.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Wade. It appears not all European countries are in sync or in step with U.S. moves when it comes to the nuclear power nation. Germany has said that it will not supply Kiev with weapons for now, something which has drawn the anger from Ukraine. Is it because of Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will examine why Germany has taken a different approach than the warmonger U.S. and if this split is true among other European nations. We will also take a look at whether the U.S.'s ultimate goal is to destabilize Central Asian countries in order to prevent, as they see it, Russia's expansionist aspirations. All right, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have Vladimir Goldstein. He's an associate professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University, who joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Also joining us, Urs Unkopf, Government Relations Director at BWA, who joins us from Berlin.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you gentlemen, and I'm going to start with you, Urs Unkopf, if I may. When it comes to Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine, what are we looking at when it comes to the U.S. position? It seems like it's pretty clear that it wants to provide arms to not only the Baltic states, if I'm correct to say that, and it also has NATO doing its military maneuvers, moving eastward and putting pressure on Russia. I mean, at this point, we're looking at the latest that we have of U.S. arms delivery, 90 tons of U.S. military aid, part of the $200 million, from what I'm reading here, of lethal aid, which is part of the $2.5 billion delivered so far. I can get into some of the details behind this. What are we looking at when it comes to this massive military injection when it comes, and it's emanating from the U.S. mainly here?
I think it is quite clear that the Biden administration and President Biden don't want to risk an immediate open war. This is why those discussions on arms delivery and all those preparatory measures are now pushed forward in the U.S. It is quite clear that Ukraine is not a NATO member, and in the Baltic states there are totally different conditions, different frameworks applying. Let me also add from the German point of view, the recent days there has been widely discussed in the German media the statement of the now former head of the German Navy, which was definitely not helpful for the debate. I think at the moment and at this phase of the conflict where we have now arrived, it is the most important task of every politician to de-escalate in every way. That means de-escalation on the military, as well as in the political level, and also important on the level of public discourse. The German Foreign Minister, Annalena Baerbock, has clearly stated during her recent visit to Moscow and during the meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, that Germany is not going to deliver arms into conflict zones, and that has also been confirmed towards the Ukrainian Foreign Minister, Dmytro Kuleba. So it is quite clear that Germany will try to use its position to negotiate and to get all the relevant stakeholders, involved parties, back to the negotiation table, because this is the most important in this situation to prevent an open war.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you have that take on this, and I'm going to ask you, Vladimir Goldstein, our guest there from Berlin, says that it doesn't seem like there's going to be a war scenario that's going to pan out of this. I'm looking at deliveries of U.S.-made Stinger shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles to Kiev. I'm looking at the U.K. Let me go down the list, who has delivered a small number of anti-armor defensive weapon systems. I mean, if it smells like war, it looks like war, it looks like there's going to be a war. What do you think? Do you think that this is the scenario set for war or not?
Well, I think it's we all know in the real world things can happen. And potentially, of course, it can be after the war. But I don't think there is interest in terms of the war, neither on the Russian side, nor on Ukrainian side, nor on European side. Of course, you know, it's in the interest of United States and probably, you know, England is somehow to create this appearance of danger, appearance of trouble, but they are definitely pursuing their own interests. There is interest of American military-industrial complex. You know, they're very active. They like to sell their weapons. There are interests of some industry sector. They are not very much interested in Russia trading with, you know, Germany. They prefer Germany and other European countries dealing, you know, with the United States, gas companies and oil companies. So they pursue their own interests. But, you know, there are endless amount of reports, including BBC and many other people, that people neither in Russia nor in Kiev feel imminent war. They know that this is just, you know, saber rattling, talk, people pursuing their own political agendas. And, you know, this is a very good example of German Navy chief Schönbach, who said that this is all kind of, the war is not happening, and the idea with Crimea is over, let's move forward, let's have pragmatic discussion. However, he was immediately forced to retire. So, in other words, the United States pushes this program, pursuing its military and economic interests, which lie not from the war, they benefit not from the war, but from fear-mongering and war-mongering and the stuff, and splitting Germany from Russia. That's another very important dimension.
Aha. So you saved the best for last. I appreciate that. Urs Unkopf, are we looking at that? Are we looking at the fact that you have, and you're in Berlin, that Germany is standing up, and as you said, they want to see if this can be worked out. They're taking the diplomatic approach. This is said to be a first major test for the Social Democrat. Scholz, also that German politicians understand Russia, so to speak, and that understanding remains alive, which is why there's a push for this to be taken down a notch or two, or even more. But is it true what our guest there said? Is there also a push somehow for Germany to be separated from Russia? Because Germany obviously is a major player in this whole scheme when it comes to European countries.
That's a very interesting question, and I would agree with many of the points my colleague mentioned so far. Of course, there are interest groups which try to push Germany back from Russia into a one-sided position towards Ukraine, but first and overall, Germany needs to align its foreign policy with its national interests. And our national interests do neither 100% comply with the Russian position nor 100% with the Ukrainian position. So that is also why the German business community and so far also the politics during the era of Angela Merkel has, for example, separated business relations from political relations. And it is also in our interest to develop good relations with Ukraine, but also on the same time to maintain those relations with Russia. Russia is one of the most important suppliers for oil and gas for Germany. Russia has fulfilled all its commitments in this sphere, and there have been various statements from different stakeholders that if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is technically ready to operate, also will be put into operation, it will not be a shutdown of a gas transit, natural gas transit through Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So all those questions needs to be discussed on a rational level. And once again, I would like to underline, we need to de-escalate and to put out the tension of this debate at the moment.
Sure. Well, you had one courageous Navy chief from Germany, Vladimir Goldstein, to stand up. He said it was nonsense to think that Russia was about to invade Ukraine, and that also praising, in a sense, the Russian President Vladimir Putin, said that he deserves respect, and then he went on to resign. This, the fact that he says it's nonsense, goes flat against what the U.S. stance is, and of course, the U.S. has pulled other countries to believe that Russia is going to invade. Is it nonsense, Russian invasion theory?
Yeah, I think it is nonsense. You know, the problem is that professionals, be it, you know, real academics, real military people, you know, Navy, German Navy have the intelligence sources. They know that very well. they can sense the mood in Ukraine, in Russia. There is no mood for war. So he just says something which kind of makes sense and based on reality. However, what I would want to stress is the amount of propaganda which one sees in British TV, in American TV, is mind-staggering. I left Russia and the Soviet Union in the 70s, and even then it wasn't such unified voice condemning this, pronouncing this, making all this kind of unified. God forbid that there is some dissent, note. The same thing is just now orchestrated by United States propaganda. So somebody who makes sense out of the blue declared a pariah and told to resign. But sooner or later, you know, there is what is important, that Germany is an economic powerhouse. They have their interests. They have their traditions. You know, Russia and Germany, what, you know, of course they were in the wars, but they were trading, they were partners. There's endless amount of cultural, political, philosophical exchanges. So these two countries are more or less have to trade with each other and have to function. And they are located very close to each other in Europe. So why not United States and England, which is also very far from the Central Europe, interfere and play their geopolitical games at the expense, I want to underline, at the expense, not Ukraine. Ukraine can find their way negotiating, de-escalating, like my colleague said, and Ukraine can function too. But they should promote American interest in the heart of Europe, because for the time being, that's what Ukraine is doing.
Well, maybe it's a good time for us to try to summarize very briefly, if you can, Urs Unkov, why it is that Russia has been demonized by the U.S., not only demonized, but also cited as a national security threat. We can go back to when they said that they meddled in the U.S. elections, but of course Ukraine was the tipping point. Why do you think that Russia is on the target of the U.S. or the radar of the U.S. to such extreme?
Well, of course, it's a geopolitical competition where we see at the moment mainly three players, the U.S., China, and Russia. And also interesting is the second part of the statement of this former German Navy chief. He mentioned that we should align stronger with Russia in order to contain China. And one, we have to understand that it is not in our interest as a power in the center of Europe, as one of Europe's strongest players, as Germany, to play Russia against China. Nor is it not in our interest to play the U.S. against Russia. And I hope that Germany in the course of this year will reset multilateral dialogue formats. Germany currently holds the presidency of the G7, which also could make a step towards Russia, towards retaking the dialogue. But at the moment, I see that we need to put out the tension of the public discourse to avoid a situation like we had before the First World War. Before the First World War started, every media, every newspaper was writing about the war and the possibility of war. And if we just talk about war and not how to avoid the war, then the war in the end will come. And this needs to be prevented with all possible forces from all stakeholders.
Well, there needs to be a reminder here, which many may seem to have forgotten because it's going back to such a long time ago, Vladimir Goldstein, and that is the fact that Ukraine has mainly not been fighting Russian armed forces in the Donbas region. People don't seem to really realize that. And you know, yes, you know, Russia may have trained or may have armed them, but they're not doing the fighting. Russia's military involvement might be more so, if anything, on the advisory part of this, which led to the separation. I mean, isn't that something that needs to be highlighted so people who are involved in this, any of the players, realize, you know, this is not Russian direct involvement?
That's absolutely the case. You know, what we know from the very recent history is, you know, Eastern Ukraine, Donbas region, were rather sympathetic to Kyiv until 2014, when, you know, they were demonized, they were immediately called separatists, traitors, blah, 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 and now recent polls conducted by Kyiv suggest that, you know, people in Donbas don't want to be part of Kyiv regime. So what we have a very serious civil tension. So people in Donbas are Russian speakers. They are Russian, you know, culturally, while Kyiv want to subjugate them, not give them autonomy, not allow them to make be their own choice. They want to subjugate them. They bombard them. They kill civilians. So far, 14,000 people were killed on all sides, but a lot of civilians. So it plays very bad in Russia, you know, because Russians feel that this is their Russian brothers. Furthermore, quite, you know, during recent times, many of the people in this Donbass region got their Russian passport. So they're technically Russians too. This is, of course, this is a complicated geopolitical game the countries play. But, you know, you have to be aware that Russia have to protect these people on eastern Donbass. So what's important is for everyone to sit at the table and discuss. But what we see that Ukraine prefers to hide that too. They prefer to talk and blame Russians. They prefer to get American aid. They prefer to play British aid. They prefer to claim victims while, you know, they haven't solved even a situation in their own territory. They didn't solve it yet. So, you know, why on earth this country, which cannot solve, you know, their own problems, dictate Germany, mm-hmm. you know, United States, Russia, Canada, what to do? It's a really big unanswered question.
There was an interesting statement that came from the U.S. President, Usunkov, just days ago, and I'd like to find out from you what you thought of it, even though he retracted that statement, and he said that a small-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine might not lead NATO to respond with full force the way that he was describing it. And that really ticked off Ukraine, and it took many by surprise, again, scrambled to take back that statement. But do you think that that is something that the U.S. Actually means, that it's okay, if it even turns out to be that way, that a small-scale incursion by Russia is something that the U.S. or NATO would tolerate?
Well, I think this statement once again shows how tense the situation is, but realistically, I think that U.S. would risk a war, which would be, in every case, a nuclear war with Russia about Ukraine. It's more about to underline how the frontiers are at the moment, and I think that it is quite obvious that Putin is a strategist and he knows quite well how far he can go. The same applies for the Biden administration. So there needs just to be defined where their faces, where both could agree on a certain format of negotiations. It might be the Minsk group, but we should also be open for new formats to find a constructive solution.
All right, let's look at this from a vantage point that's not just about war and the possibility of it. Vladimir Goldstein, we know what had happened in Ukraine. The U.S. pretty much came out and said it was involved in the color revolution. They like colors. There was a revolution there. I think it was called purple for that color. I forget. Maybe you can tell us. So based on that, what color was it?
Orange,
I'm sorry. Okay, so you have that execution by the U.S., which stirred up the country, and some are suggesting, some analysts, that that's what the U.S. is actually after, Central Europe and the European countries that maybe were in the sphere of Russia, to create some kind of instability, Kyrgyzstan being the latest example, and this would then be a bulwark against Russia to prevent Russia from wanting to expand in their eyes. Do you think that that is the case?
Yeah, that's the case. You know, what we have to remember that after collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia was a kind of very weak and very weak on the international space. So United States believed that they can sort of call all the shots. So they, you know, play their games with Europe. They expanded NATO. And, you know, it worked very well in their favor, and they want to continue this way. So obviously when Russia becomes more self-assertive, it's already kind of a threat. So they are, you know, using that. But also in terms of geopolitics, we do have to remember that Europe is Europe. And this is very, you know, if we have EU and Russia, and, you know, after all, China wants to trade there. If this is a very powerful bloc, trading together, working together economically, then United States is actually an odd man out. They can be somewhere trading with Latin America, but they'll be kicked out of Europe because they're not placed there. They're geographically, they're not located. So they don't want to accept it. They want to stay in Europe. So I think this, you know, this certain Eastern European countries like Poland, Baltics, and Ukraine are their foothold, and they will do everything to protect it, which, you know, works, A, they preserve American interests, and B, due to geographical location of Ukraine, it is precisely the place, Ukraine and Poland, they separate Russia and Germany from, getting a very, a consistent economic relationship, which has, been all the time. If you look at the history, you just mentioned First World War. One of the ideas, there were negotiations between Russia and Germany. They wanted to work together, but for England, it was absolute sort of taboo. So they did all they could to set up Russia against Germany, and I think that's a pretty successful strategy of Anglo, sphere to somehow to keep these two countries very separate from each other because it's in their interest.
All right, so since we're drawing down with the time here, Urs Unkopf, it should all come down to the economy, and I'm looking at the point of view of Germany, looking at the situation, and even other European countries. If they're going to be pressured by the U.S., I'm sure the question comes about, so what will we gain by going against Russia? Is the U.S. pressuring these countries with economic incentives to go against Russia? Even though Russia, as I'm sure you're well aware, not only is a very big supplier of a variety of goods for Germany, perhaps, but in the bigger picture for Europe and the European Union. So how can the U.S. pressure these countries to go against Russia?
We had such a situation already when some senators from the Republicans announced that they would sanction all companies directly or indirectly working on the Nord Stream 2 project, but the German economy in general has a strong commitment in Russia as well as in Ukraine, and also our association has a reliable partner in both countries, so the German economy needs to define its own interests, and that can only be that we can continue with stable and good businesses in this region. Russia is a very important traditional partner since the 1970s, Russia delivers a significant share of Germany's energy consumption. Mm-hmm. However, there has been a common European effort in Ukraine within the last year, especially in regional developments, and also those efforts should not be taken off. So I think in a mid to long term perspective, also economic relations could help to build new bridges when politics fail. To find a common ground of speech, the economy can build new bridges.
Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Vladimir Goldstein, many thanks for your contribution. Associate Professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University from Providence, Rhode Island. And Urs Unkopf, thank you. Government Relations Director at BWA from Berlin. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Vitakhov, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us two very, very special guests. On my right, we have Sister Asma. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
And on my left, Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam and assalamu alaikum from my end.
Sister Zainab, I've met you before, I've worked with you before, but could you give a brief introduction about yourself? I mean, who are you? Where have you come from?
I am Zainab Askari. I am from the Indian occupied Kashmir, and I'm done with masters in linguistics from Kashmir University, and then I came to Iran. It's been 7 years I'm here. I am studying Hausa right now.
Uh-huh. So linguistics, you're going to be dealing with like
the rules of translation, phonetics, syntax, morphology, what we do in SARF and now stuff.
You're my teacher. And